It actually started at the end of the Cold War. Some of the U.S. military engagements in the 90s actually involved the Guard and Reserves a lot more, but after 9/11, the use of the Guard and Reserves just exploded, and policymakers were really pretty late to the game, catching up, thinking about the laws and the budgets and the policies that would be required to support a Guard and Reserves that were working that hard.
And your report goes through budget concerns, but also policy and legal concerns. Let's start off with money, because money is one of the big issues.
Right. So one of the things that's happened in the past at the Pentagon is when policymakers get a sense that budgets may be going down, their first instinct is to cut the Guard and Reserves. The reason for that is because there's a sort of lingering rivalry between full-time active duty personnel and between Guard and Reserves personnel. But the real thing to keep in mind is that the Guard and Reserves are actually quite cost-effective because they only serve part-time, and because a lot of them have skills that they acquire in their civilian careers that are very difficult to find in the full-time active duty ranks. The Guard and Reserves actually present a quite cost-effective option for the future, which is important considering that the defense budget may be going down in the years ahead, and also that we're just living in a time of fiscal austerity.
And so this rivalry ends up actually costing DOD money.
Yes, it does. The thing that's interesting here is that the Vietnam War is the only conflict in U.S. history where the Guard and Reserves were not used, were not mobilized on a large-scale basis. The draft was used, and President Lyndon Johnson decided that he didn't want to use the Guard and Reserves. Well, if you fast forward to today, many of the senior-level policymakers in the Pentagon, well, they served in Vietnam, and Vietnam represents their formative experience.
Yeah.
So in their formative experience, the Guard and Reserves were not present. So it really has taken a cultural catch-up on their parts in order to understand that the Guard and Reserves of today are not your father's National Guard and Reserves.
We're talking to Travis Sharp. He is one of the authors of a report called An Indispensable Force. It looks at the National Guard and Reserves. Talk a little bit about the legal and the policy issues that are here, because I think those don't get, we're in Washington, we follow the money. So that often gets a lot of attention, but the legal and policy issues sometimes don't get as much attention.
That's right. I think one of the most important issues here is the National Guard is constitutionally mandated to be a dual force. It serves at home, protecting the homeland, supporting other agencies during disasters, and then, of course, it also serves abroad in U.S. military engagements overseas. The problem is because you're dealing with different levels of government and different government agencies, cooperation is often very difficult. So to give you just one example on the legal issues, right now, if a hurricane is approaching an American city, it is very difficult to mobilize reservists to come to the support of that city and to provide capabilities that may be needed to help save lives. It's just a legal authority issue that needs to be ironed out, but, you know, we're years after Hurricane Katrina and years after 9/11, and it still hasn't been solved. And we think that's an urgent problem that policymakers need to deal with.
Has much been done, and there's been a lot written, and you guys have written about a lot, about the stress of the really much longer than most National Guard forces expected to be either in Iraq, Afghanistan, or other places. And that's put a lot of strain not only on those people themselves, but on their families and on the structure itself. Anything been done to really deal with that?
There has. Congress has actually done a pretty commendable job of supporting the National Guard and Reserves over the last few years, specifically through programs like the Wounded Warrior Program and the Yellow Ribbon Reintegration Program, which helps people coming back from the wars get back into their civilian roles. But those problems have not been overcome. For example, Army National Guardsmen and Reservists are committing suicide more frequently this year than their active duty counterparts.
Wow.
There's a number of factors that contribute to that. One of them is that it's a little bit tougher to monitor guardsmen and reservists when they're having problems because they're not on a base and they're not always around their military colleagues. So, you know, some of these signs are very, very concerning. When you combine it with the continuing economic troubles that we're facing and that guardsmen and reservists have to face more than active duty members because they are, after all, civilians, it adds up to a picture where policymakers need to continue to be engaged to help these service members who have served so valiantly over the last decade.
And you also write, and one of the things that was a little bit, frankly, chilling in your report is that a lot of the National Guard and Army Reserve and all the reserve forces don't always have the equipment that they need to do some of the critical jobs that they are being called on to carry out.
That's right. At the beginning of the current fiscal year 2010, the Army Reserve, the Army Guard, the Air National Guard, and the Marine Corps Reserve all lacked at least 25% of the equipment that they required. Now, there are ways to make up for that shortage without just spending a lot of money on new equipment. For example, Assistant Secretary of Defense for Reserve Affairs Dennis McCarthy last week suggested the use of simulators to try to replicate some of the training that these service members will need before they go on deployments. Nonetheless, being a quarter short of the requirement for equipment represents a real problem to readiness, because when you don't train on the equipment that you're going to use during a deployment, you're just not as ready. It takes more time to get trained up, and the overall effect is to hurt U.S. military effectiveness. Hmm.
Is the overall solution to this to increase the size of the non-reserve force of the actual military personnel, or does that just seem overly simplistic?
I think that there's a few large reforms that could be instituted that would help a lot of this. The first is education. When National Guardsmen and reservists and active duty military personnel learn together, when they're in classes together, when they take curricula that are related to Guard and Reserves policy, it can really help to unify the force, and so that can help to knock down some of these lingering rivalries. Another solution is what we call the continuum of service, which is a personnel management solution for the 21st century. Basically, what we want to do here is we want to make it easier for people to move from active duty to Guard and Reserve duty, because we think that, you know, this day and age, people don't expect to be at the same job for 40 years. They expect to shift jobs pretty frequently during their careers. So by varying military service for different levels of people's lives, we think that we can attract the best and the brightest to continue to serve the nation and tap into some of those really complex skills that we're going to need for these military missions of the future.
And I know that the National Reserve and all the reserves had had troubles with recruitment levels, and that has eased off some. In fact, in some cases, there's surpluses. And I know some economists say, hey, that's mostly because there aren't that many great jobs out there right now. Does that alleviate some of the push for some of these changes, because people say, hey, look, not really as bad of a problem as it used to be?
I mean, there's been no doubt that the recruitment has continued to be a very positive sign across the U.S. military, and especially in the National Guard and Reserves. I take that more as a signal that the National Guard and Reserves, the people that are serving today, have either joined or rejoined since September 11th. In other words, they've joined the National Guard and Reserves as it's being used currently, not as it used to be used, which was as a weekend warrior force. So what I think that indicates is that, you know, there are some proposals out there right now about returning the Guard and Reserves back to its weekend warrior status. And I think that that's just not why a lot of these people joined up. I think a lot of them joined up because they wanted to serve operationally. They were ready to be deployed. And so I think that there's a serious risk that if we go back to the bad old days, as it were, that many of these people are going to quit, and we're going to find that our Guard and Reserves are not as strong as they are today.